name is John Baker. I teach at LSU Law School, and I direct the Hemisphere Trade Program there. I want to give a little longer introduction in a few minutes, but to accommodate Ambassador Bolton, who's been so kind to come and open this program for us, I want to get right to his remarks. The great thing about having someone like Ambassador Bolton is you really don't have to introduce him, and so therefore the only thing that I want to say about him are a few things, two things that you may not know that connect with our subject today. Long before he became really famous, he was still well known in conservative circles, and among his other positions, he was Assistant Administrator for Program and Policy Coordination at USAID in the early 80s, and then he was General Counsel from 74 to 81 as well. So without further ado, let me introduce someone who certainly needs no introduction to this audience, Ambassador John Bolton. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here. The Federalist Society has been something that I've been pleased to participate in its activities for many years, and it's a critically important institution. And one of the things that I've been especially happy to see is it's expanded its interest in international subjects and its international activities, I think, is a very important direction to go in. I want to talk a little bit about issues of international security and how they affect economic development, because the connection is very real in many respects, and I think especially in Latin America today, where the direction things are going is not terribly promising, and where I think a number of initiatives and successes over recent years now are threatened because of the developments relating to political and security issues. And I think this goes critically to the likelihood of success of initiatives to develop systems of property and rule of law, because they are directly related to the attractiveness that systems having these attributes have for foreign trade and investment. And I think the correlation is very clear, and in a time of supposed increased globalization, in fact, there are many areas that many countries that, not having established clear systems of property rights and independent judiciaries and strong rule of law, are not benefiting from globalization, not benefiting from the increased trade and investment that comes from it, and therefore are sources of information and political support for the people around the world who, for all kinds of different reasons, don't like globalization to begin with, people who are fundamentally statist in their orientation or nationalistic, that don't equate the benefits of a broadly liberal international trade order in the same way that at least people in the United States predominantly do. And I think in Latin America, we came through a decade in the 1990s, late 80s, early 90s, of enormous promise and opening to the possibility of greater hemispheric integration, where you saw a lot of long-standing historical attitudes in both Latin America and the Caribbean and the United States disappearing. It was a time when I think a lot of state-owned enterprises were being divested, where the strictures against private foreign investment that were falling, where there were possibilities where the two of them were combined, where telecommunication systems were being privatized and open to foreign and especially American investment. And my personal view in the by the mid-1990s, I really thought that we had not only moved beyond the Cold War in global international terms, but within the Western Hemisphere had moved past a lot of strongly held, historically derived views that that really inhibited closer relations between the United States and Latin American, Central American, Caribbean governments, which I think had those trends persisted would have been to the benefit of everyone at a time when NAFTA was being negotiated and approved, when the possibility of additional bilateral trade agreements were seemed to be making a lot of progress, when this will take you back 15 years or more, when Mercosur was not seen as something that was directed against the United States, but was seen as a way of reducing trade barriers, at least in partial terms, that would help open up hemispheric trade more generally. Now that I'm back at AEI, there is a very strong view held by most of the people at AEI who study international trade that these bilateral or plurilateral trade agreements are not to be preferred when you look at global rounds like Doha or other rounds in the WTO. I understand that point of view intellectually. I think when you look as a practical political matter at changing some of these historically derived attitudes that sometimes bilateral or regional trade agreements are actually ways of breaking existing habits of thinking. Ultimately, you want to do it on a global basis, but it's not a zero-sum game. Anyway, my impression pretty strongly in the mid-1990s was that there was an awful lot of progress being made in terms of opening up Latin America to foreign investment, especially from North America, and that the prospect of closer integration economically and politically was very strong, and I think that would have had it continued, a very powerful positive impact on the economies of Latin American countries and therefore on the lives of their citizens, which would have been a good thing for everybody. It looked with the end of the Cold War, frankly, that the divisions caused by Cold War tensions, the efforts of the then Soviet Union through Castro and his regime in Cuba were going to disappear, that these external political issues would no longer be a factor inhibiting closer relations in this hemisphere, and that in the absence of some external political rationale, people could make essentially economic decisions on essentially economic terms. That happy forecast, and maybe I was the only one who believed in it, but I think it was more broadly shared than that, has obviously come unstuck for a variety of reasons in the hemisphere, some of which have to do with international economic factors like the debt crisis and related events. But a lot of it has to do with the internal politics of many of the Latin American countries. And perhaps undoubtedly in its most acute form in Venezuela. And the issue that we face now, I think, is not the more optimistic view of how to increase hemispheric integration, but the opposite, how to prevent political instability in many Latin American countries, but a reversion to, if not completely autarkic economic principles, at least resistance to increased international involvement. And I think that has its corollary effect in domestic policy in the Latin American countries by a decreased willingness to create systems of property rights and rule of law institutions that would permit the development of more integration into the international commercial economy. Now, Chavez is complex in many respects, although it's also kind of quintessentially Venezuelan. I remember my only visit to Venezuela was in January of 1992, right after Venezuela had been elected to the Security Council, and so I went down in the Bush 41 administration for consultations on what their membership would involve, and I remember very vividly being driven to the presidential compound to meet with Carlos Andres Perez, who was the president then, and as we drove up, I could see that the walls of the compound had obviously been splattered with bullets, and you could see the very distinctive impact of the bullet and the plaster cracking around it. And, of course, I had known that there had been a coup, and this was the coup attempt the week before. This was the visible evidence of that coup led by a disaffected army officer named Hugo Chavez. So they quite properly put him in jail at the time, and obviously not long enough. And he came back, and if you look at the political situation in Venezuela now, for those who study it closely, I think they would say that the opposition to Chavez is so divided that that Chavez himself is so artful at using the Venezuelan oil revenues to spread around to the poor people, the unemployed, the disaffected, that it's and having packed the military to his satisfaction, it's hard now to see how Venezuela breaks out of Hugo Chavez's rule. That the democratic alternative doesn't seem open. That the United States, having had an opportunity to support a counter coup against Chavez a few years ago, and having declined that opportunity because of our devotion to supposedly the democratic processes, which Chavez, having avoided the counter coup, was then in turn able to frustrate even more. I think the pessimistic, but I think also realistic prospect is that Venezuela is stuck with Chavez for the foreseeable future. And as long as oil prices remain where they are, he has a funding source that is completely independent of any potential democratic control. Even if his opponents could succeed in getting a majority in the Venezuelan Congress, he has a source of revenue utterly independent of their taxation authority. So what that means is that the happy prospect of avoiding a hemispheric troublemaker has fallen by the wayside. And while it's true that Chavez's ideology is incoherent, to state it most bluntly, that doesn't mean that he is potentially less of a problem than Castro was. Although, as someone described Chavez, he's sort of like Castro without brains. He is nonetheless dangerous despite that. He may not have a coherent Marxist ideology, but he's got enough of a view on key issues that he's obviously going to be a problem. And unlike Castro, he has his own source of financing. Throughout all of the years that the Soviet Union subsidized Cuba by the essentially below market exchange of Cuban sugar for Soviet oil, and the provision of weapons and finance to participate in subversion within this hemisphere and in Africa and elsewhere, Castro was always on a pretty tight leash from his Soviet paymasters. In the case of Chavez, while he obviously has domestic economic demands on the oil revenues that he derives, he can determine, subject to the market price of oil, how much he's going to spend on his activities interfering around the hemisphere. And we can see already that he has used considerable amounts of money to try and influence elections in Peru and Ecuador, Bolivia, Colombia. His financing was critical in the post-election recount controversy in Mexico's recent close presidential election. And this is just the visible tip of what we know, or what people have some degree of confidence in suggesting that he's doing. I would say, actually, the one sort of source of optimism that I have on this subject is that many leaders in other Latin American countries, even leaders on the leftermost side of the political spectrum, have come to appreciate what a threat that Chavez is. It was quite interesting to me in my encounter with Venezuela last fall and the UN when Venezuela was seeking a non-permanent seat on the Security Council. Normally, the United States doesn't get involved in these elections. Normally, the regional groups arrive at a consensus around a particular candidate for a non-permanent seat, and then the rest of the General Assembly rubber stamps that. What happened in last year's election was that Guatemala, which obviously emerging from a military autocracy, had never been a Security Council member. Despite being a founding member of the UN, Guatemala had declared its candidacy, and Chavez decided that actually he'd like to see Venezuela get that seat. This was another example on a kind of small scale, for what it's worth, of the use of the oil revenue for Chavez's purposes. He used a variety of devices to gain support in and outside of Latin America. His purchase of Argentina's debt was one where he used to get their support. There were concessional trade arrangements on oil exports for other countries, and quite frankly, there was just the free use of cash in capitals and in New York to call attention, we'll say, to the favorable aspects of Venezuela's candidacy for a non-permanent seat. But one of the things that emerged in the course of that struggle, where Venezuela was ultimately defeated and both they and Guatemala withdrew in favor of Panama, was the perception that I gained from a number of Latin American diplomats as to just how dangerous they saw Chavez as being for the region, appreciating that the fragility of democracy in many of these countries could be threatened, in this case not by some Norte Americano, but by somebody like Chavez, who had a very different agenda, but potentially dispositive amounts of money that he could throw around. The reach of Chavez's activities, I think, is something that we don't fully appreciate, but the destabilizing effect that he has in terms of the political structures of other Latin American countries, and therefore their ability to foster a rule of law system in the economic area, I think is very widespread. We know, in addition, for example, that last year Venezuela purchased 100,000 AK-47s from Russia. Now, that is an amount far in excess of any legitimate need of the Venezuelan military, which leads to the inference that he's purchased those weapons for use somewhere else. We protested this to the Russians, and they said, well, you know, he's got the money and we've got the AK-47s and we're going to go through with the deal. They made no claim that it was for legitimate defense needs for Venezuela. They were in the business of earning hard currency, and since oil is normally accounted for in dollars, the Russians were being paid for these AK-47s in dollar-denominated deposits. We also know that Chavez has made the rounds in Tehran, in Damascus, and in various other problematic locations. I don't doubt that he is looking for friends among the world's rogue states and anti-Americans, either for political support, potentially with other oil-producing states, obviously, for economic leverage as well, all of which indicates that he thinks he's going to be around for a while and that he has a lot of trouble to cause. So this can't be good for efforts domestically anywhere in South or Central America or the Caribbean, for the kinds of activities that would lead to systems of property rights and rule of law adjudication of commercial disputes. And the obvious impact of continued political instability is going to be an inhibition on flows of foreign direct investment and the like. So I think this is, although not as ideologically driven, not with necessarily the global implications that Castro's subversive activities had throughout the hemisphere, but nonetheless with an enormous potential to do a lot of damage both in other Western Hemisphere economies and in the relationship between the hemisphere and the United States, I think Chavez is a real problem going into the future. And I suspect, given our current situation, this is a problem that will have to be dealt with largely by other Latin American leaders, given the oil resources he has and given the pattern of behavior that many of them, particularly in the South American countries, have followed so far, is not encouraging. So although the United States is often criticized for its interference in Latin American affairs, I think more realistically in the past several decades the problem has been a lack of attention by the United States to relations in the hemisphere, and I think that's clearly something that we need to correct going forward. So thank you very much for the chance to be here, and good luck on the conference. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have here on these subjects. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
And as we look at our future budget and foreign aid, like other agencies, of course, we're constrained. And one of the places that we seem to be planning to cut our resources is in Latin America. Do you think that's appropriate given this more challenging political environment? Should we just give up on some of these property rights reforms because it is more challenging, or do you see some hope here?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to give up on them because I think fundamentally these are more important issues for long-term economic development than resource transfers in countries where the budgets are relatively large. And we're talking a little bit before we began, and I've obviously tried to follow this over the years. I'd have to say I'm somewhat disappointed because these were the same debates I had in 1981 and 1982 and 1980. I mean, you know, you'd think after a while that you could resolve something and move forward, but until it does get resolved, clearly, to lose the opportunity, especially in our own hemisphere, I think would be a big, big mistake, and it would be unfortunately typical of the pattern I just mentioned that the United States doesn't pay as much attention as it should. People complain we pay too much attention, we're too interfering in Latin America. I think exactly the opposite has been true in recent years, and I'd hate to see that continued into the future.
Did that change at all with the President's trip to Latin America?
Well, I think that was, you know, this is, people said when he was elected, well, now we've got a governor of Texas, and, you know, he'll pay more attention to Latin America because of the relationship with Mexico and whatnot, and then September, and I think he would have wanted to have done that, and then September the 11th happened, and everybody's attention got diverted in ways no one had anticipated. So I would say, if you ask him, he would probably say the trip was long overdue, and, you know, it comes late in the administration, but it's not too late to get started, and I think he demonstrated by reaching out to President Lula of Brazil, hardly somebody you'd say was an ideological ally, that he's looking at interests in that case, Brazil and the United States have in common, and that can be a basis on which you can cooperate to mutual advantage.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm Georgia Sambenares with USAID. Thank you for your presentation. I would like your advice and views on the opportunities for private banks to maybe assist in the situation with Latin America, because I think post-NAFTA, I know especially in Mexico, there was the opening of some of the banking sector, and Spain has gone in with some of their subsidiaries, and it seems that the Citibank predominant role has opened up a little bit more to both host counterparts as well as international investment banks. And now that we're beyond the debt crisis, do you see any opportunity for banks to regain trust and maybe assist in the development issues in Latin America?
I hate to ask you this question, but did your father work for AID?
No.
No? Okay. It was the last name sounds familiar. Well, I think I would have said, I'm just showing my age, that's all. I would have said in the 90s that the financial sector was in fact one of the areas where the possibility of greater hemispheric integration was strongest, and yet that is obviously not played out. I think the Europeans have been more determined to make a breakthrough, and I think fairly cynical about the way the European Union performs. They see obviously the historical relationship between Spain and Portugal and this hemisphere, and they're using their national financial institutions and others to open up possibilities in these markets that will then be used to the broader benefit of the European Union as a whole and to our detriment. I think banks have obvious interest in clearer delineation of property rights so that they can securitize them and they can use them as collateral. And if you don't have clear definitions of property, banks have difficulty in operating beyond just the most informal kinds of arrangements, which means especially for American banks or foreign banks generally in a region like that is going to be problematic. So, yes, I would say it's strongly in the interest of not just outside institutions but of Latin American financial institutions to support this because it means their own operations and, you know, hopefully their own profitability would expand. I just take one more here if I could. Yes, sir.
Merrill Smith. Wouldn't one of the most effective measures towards Latin America, especially Brazil that you mentioned, be to reduce our protectionist trade policies with respect to oranges and sugar And especially sugar, I mentioned, because of its potential as an ethanol source and an alternative to Venezuelan and other oil sources. What's the obstacle?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, the debates in this country in the 1990s were very strongly in the area of agricultural subsidies. We were going to cut the subsidies to domestic farmers and try and open up in terms of trade. It would benefit American consumers by definition, and obviously it would benefit the exporting countries. And all we have to do is solve our political problem in Congress and move ahead with it. But I couldn't agree more. I think that's it is hard to motivate an amorphous mass of consumers, or hard to motivate people to see that they benefit from reduced trade restrictions like that, and you can always find some group that feels that it's disadvantaged, and that group tends to predominate. But I think from the U.S. point of view, that's why getting through the Doha round and beyond that, especially in the agricultural area, ultimately would be beneficial. And be beneficial for the United States in terms of some of its agricultural exports, where we would have a comparative advantage compared to areas where we don't. Okay, well, thank you very much. Good luck to you. I hope you have a good time.